Your song sheet will be appearing here in a moment. It may be familiar. I think one or two of you would have sung this before. Traditional words will be on the right-hand side, new alternative words on the left. You're welcome to choose whichever version you prefer. They are both going to be sung simultaneously in true pantomime fashion. And of course, your choice of version will be the one that's sung the loudest. So, would you all please stand? There will be an introduction.
Concur with each other and see different versions from different traditions, and that was absolutely evident this morning. Perfectly clear, you all knew about pantomimes as well. And talking of pantomimes, I like the recycling of the badges. I got a blank one, but my wife, whom I've been married to for nearly 50 years, got one which is the Gurney Haddock. So I came to a tipping point. A happy married man, and I come back with a Gurney Haddock. So anyway, I'm going to make a really short presentation. I'm going to try and pick up the threads of the last 2 days and offer a few thoughts for the future. Very simply, I would suggest that however much the market may fail, we must not tolerate a failure of the imagination. Now, it could well be, and I find these facts very confusing, but it could well be that we are on the brink of an ecological collapse. That the past 200 years of industrial development have been a doubtful blessing. And then we may need to learn from certain pre-industrial societies and their relationship with the planet if we wanted to survive with any quality and any dignity. But whatever, we must not lose the poetry, the stories. We must play music. And the envelope of art is a way of giving, being, and perceiving. Well, who am I to say this? Well, very briefly, my story is really a part of the story of Welfare State International. In 1968, Sue Gill and I, and a lot of other people, started Welfare State to create, as we then said, an alternative, an entertainment, and a way of life. The company invented prototypes of site-specific theatre, such as carnival operas, installations, site-specific theatre, and lantern processions. And such celebratory, community, participatory art has really had a major effect on mainstream culture. You can have it in between. On April Fool's Day 2006, however, we archived the company very simply because we felt that our first job was done. There was always too much spectacle about, and much of it had been hijacked by a commodity agenda. The edge had gone elsewhere. So we started a new company called Dead Good Guys to look at ecology, to examine perception, consciousness of dreaming with our eyes wide open, and to research how life of creativity and sustainability might fit together. So we moved to a wooden steel house, an eco house with a grass roof on the west shore of Morecambe Bay, where we have been making the weather station project. This uses art, woodcuts, etchings, films, poetry, photography, celebrations, family events, and so on. And we have also developed a lot of new work in rites of passage, believing that art is needed, but frequently missing, at funerals, weddings, namings, and key crossroads in people's lives. I won't say much more about this, but if you want to check out the Rochester State Updated Guide, just Google it and there's a lot of stuff there. But what I will say is, and I think in a way we've circled a little bit around this event, we need to look at death. We need to look at death clearly in the face. And I believe that if we confront our own mortality, it is probably the most radical thing we do. It certainly sorts our priorities, and it certainly sorts our whole way of being. In our work, we've collaborated with scientists, and we've made a film about the critters in Morecambe Bay. These are micro-marine critters that are just a fraction of a millimetre long. And in one square metre, we found 29,000 of these critters that were pulsating under the surface, shrimps, mollusks, worms, and so on. And we made a film, really, to declare the wonder of it. Blake didn't have access to a microscope, but we do. And there is this extraordinary wonder of the planet under our feet. And this is, I think, how we need to celebrate it, but to mark it, obviously, within the global and local context. And this is why Sue and I are here today. Well, so far, the experience of Tipping Point has been, for me, hard. How has it been for you guys? Hard? Or uncertain? Or... I found, particularly after the first day, that my whole head was completely scrambled with an excess of inputs, hard to digest. And we were in a somewhat brittle and noisy venue. And I think many people suffered a kind of confusion. But I also think there was a head domination. And in the first 10 minutes on Wednesday, when we arrived, the words real and reality were mentioned 6 times. Now, I'm not sure what real means. Neither was T.S. Eliot, I guess. Bert Norton, 1944. Go, 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 said Bert. Humankind cannot bear very much reality. Time past and time future, what might have been and what has been, point to one end, which is always present. Now, that's an ecological awareness, and that was written in 1944. So what does this word mean? I mean, when Kevin Anderson gave us the phrase, going beyond dangerous, and there were so many, I can only remember a few, 1% of the population makes 50% emissions. We're using 4 kilowatts of power in this room when it's light outside. 13 out of 18 scenarios are impossible. I found this frightening and salutary, especially when we got to shutting down civilization and driving people into poverty, as we were saying. But as always, it's individual people with their personal stories which gave me hope and belief. And there were literally scores of wonderful stories. In my show and tell group, for instance, Jane Frost talks about how she pulls back from the edge by connecting with landscape, and how she had abandoned the commercial dyeing industry and found real dyes and real fabrics, and that she never bought new clothes now, she just recycled it all. And it was a wonderful, poetic encapsulation. And then on the other side, at a top of me, there's Kate Cairns, who recounted her dynamic cycle campaign against the blind spot on trucks after her sister was killed on a bike. Sustainable anger kept coming up. But these stories, and many others, transcended anger. They were about determination and belief, resilience, and yes, reality. The Art of Chaos even gave me another handle. Gregory Normanton said, the enormity that the questions are so great that they can censor us. And yet, we cannot ignore the envelope of the environment and ecology. Jane Griffiths wrote a beautiful story, making the personal both public and unforgettable. In the Blitz, on fire duty, her grandfather received a message to visit his own home, to find an incendiary bomb lodged in the spiral stair. I will never forget that story. Neither will I forget Jay's thought from Emily Dickinson saying, "Tell the truth, but tell it slant." Heather Ackroyd then recounted the story of the man who planted trees, where from the simplest possible fable, a movement changed ecological awareness, as much as had Joseph Beuys. I thought the sensual connection was probably more valuable to me than what people rather attacked, I think a little unkindly, as two blokes boxed out over data. But what is the case is we remember the words. We remember words that breathe ideas, and we remember clear images. We will all remember Motown, Grotown, as much as it charts a simple, relevant, beautiful, realised archetype of flow, the floating moon. Wonderful, simple idea, beautifully realised. So, is art and its poetry and the imagination world, that is the world below the surface, one way to hold us together to gain peace of mind? Has this anything to do with the dappled future that Paul Allen mentioned? A necklace, as I see it, of dappled futures and dappled oases going forwards that we can connect to, such as we saw in the glory of A. Is this place of ecological awareness and sanity the place we need, where we need a new iconography to inform old belief structures with new stories, myths and poetry? And where do we find these stories? Well, I've been researching Agent Orange and how that disaster continues and how the Admiral who soon set it off then had a deformed child, or his own son was impregnated with poison, and then their child, his child was brain damaged. And it was a story of kind of hubris, really. And I was asking James Blood, Malcolm's friend down here, what stories you could find would actually hold this. And she talked to me about the Greek story of what I call Eric the Sixth, as I can't pronounce him properly. But it's about Eric Sixth, the man who was arrogant and impious, who dared to fell timber in the sacred grove of Demeter. And as a punishment, Ceres, the goddess of harvest, sent famine to dwell in his entrails so that he was continuously tormented with an insatiable hunger. He ate of all the food in sight, and he sold all his possessions to buy more and more, and still he was not satisfied, until finally he began to assuage his raging hunger by devouring himself, gnawing his own limbs, and continuing his desperate quest for food until he had consumed himself entirely. Now that seems quite a good parable or fable that we could use. And in fact, Ted Hughes also spotted it in his Tales from Ovid, again, thanks to Malcolm. And just the last verse of this brings home the point about how the power of the image and the reality of the facts is contained within a very tight image. The famine was in her father, but none of it was enough. Whatever he ate, maddened and tormented, that hunger to angry, uglier life, the life of a monster, no longer a man, and so on. At last, inevitable, he began to savage his own limbs, and there, at a final feast, devoured himself. Is that not what, to an extent, our culture is doing? So let's look at art. If art is being, what do we mean by art? What is it? Where is it being? Where is it going to? Well, I believe that artists shift perception and they demonstrate imaginative possibilities. But I also believe that we need a new kind of art, because unfortunately, like so much else in our market-driven culture, art has been hijacked by money, celebrity, novelty and spectacle. It has been turned from a process into a product. The spectator has come about over the last 200 years as a result of urbanisation, imperialism, electronic technology, the media and all the pervading economy which generates false needs for passive consumers constipated with too much choice and alienated into political apathy. There is another way. I call it vernacular art. And this is quite a lot to Clark Mackey, a Canadian, who's written a book called Random Acts of Culture, which has just been published. Which deals with a kind of history of vernacular culture. Vernacular art, all those creative activities that people engage in daily, which we saw on air, and which give meaning to their lives. We need to reclaim these for communities of the 21st century. We need to replace spectators with gatherings, congregations, and participators. In reclaiming art and community, people will create and celebrate in partnership, together with ceremonies or rites of passage, carnivals, cooking, gardening, building houses, telling stories, playing music and making life-enhancing participatory festivals. Now such work is context-dependent, and I agree with the thoughts that we have from Ben Twist on Guernica. How often does a work of art really change behaviour? But what exactly do we mean by that? Ben said what we need, in fact, is to put it into a particular context. And I think this is what we need to claim and not be hypnotised by the gatekeepers of culture. So the work I'm advocating, which is there all the time, just needs to be brought more to the fore, and it needs to be supported, because we have at the centre now an institutionalised, bureaucratised form of kind of art, which is brilliant. But there are other ways. And this work is context-dependent. You have to participate. It's playful and improvised. Economically, it depends on a gift relationship which can't be bought or sold. When you think about the blood transfusion service, and that is the most altruistic act, which we still have here, but we don't necessarily, blood is sold in the States, but it isn't here. So we are able to work together in such a gift relationship. It's a useful counterpoint to our doleful system of capitalist conscription. It's time we replace the banality of economic regeneration with the rejuvenation of the soul. So this is my plea. We go to art, but new art. A playful art that demonstrates what it is to be human, where consciousness is shifted to a realm of poetic resonance, a realm of visceral, sensual, aesthetic collaboration, a truly ecological poetry, one of love. And love is a connection, a choice, and a collaboration, where art is indeed a way of being and a mode of knowledge. And I'll finish with a couple of poems. I wrote a little while ago, and the way synchronicity works has actually worked a lot in this conference for me, is I arrive in the museum, we're coming back entrance, and it's a very surreal entrance, and there, immediately in front of me, is a stuffed wolf. And I've just written a poem about a wolf. And the last wolf in England, everybody has this story, it's the same wolf that keeps recurring, but we'll say that the last wolf in England is thought to have been killed on Humphrey Head, a finger of land that points into Morecambe Bay, opposite our beach house. The last wolf. After the Crusades, he killed the last wolf in England. One infidel is as good as another. So in romantic paradise, wilderness was anaesthetized. Children acquired Wordsworth goggles, lest black thorns scrape their eyes, while nature was reduced to television size. Yet, ghost prints are on our lawn, and the wilderness is in the wood, lurking in coughing fits of blood. the poetry and the facts can be scary and can bring us down. We know that, but I don't think there's any point in pretending and ignoring. We have to face it. But I think we need some kind of songs or stories or poems which we must all start writing. We all can write. Because I've heard a few people in this conference saying, you know, I'm not an artist. And please, that's propaganda. Everybody's an artist. Everybody's creative. And we've been told largely by a rather peculiar education system that only some people can create and some people especially, but it is not true. So I wanted to write a poem about redemption, a kind of creation myth that's come out of this event, but one that will stay with us maybe as an example of one man transcending despair. It's called Taxidermist. In his grey tray of wings clipped from fallen birds, he sprinkles borax to mummify the jewels of goldfinch, blue-tit, thrush and hawk. He tweezers and sable brush, he plucks tufts and feathers, binds them with oiled cotton to filigrees of bone. Then, taking each filigree of bone, each with its tying of feathers, he places one over the other, one upon another, until the small tree is conjured into the evening. After the flood, his beach house grew from breakwater beams. After the flood, he took the huge rudder of the ancient ark, sliced a plank from its barnacled side, and lowered it above the fireplace he now calls home. Here, he places the bone of the tree. The fire judders, sparks flying constellations, just about illuminating the jewels of goldfinch, blue-tit, thrush and hawk, and the ivory edge of bone.